The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, bright and early on Monday morning, where I got to say, Mr. Kevin Arnovitz, I did not expect to be here on Monday morning talking about a Clippers-Nuggets Game 7 after the Clippers got a pretty mundane win in Game 4. I think they won by 11. Montrezl Harrell had 15 and 10 in that game and kind of looked like snarling bulldog Montrezl Harrell was back. And then the same movie repeated twice over the weekend in games 5 and 6. Clippers get up big. Denver ropes them back in. And Denver doesn't just come back. There's got to be a word for the comeback where it's a big comeback. And then the comeback team just stomps you and wins by 10 or 15 points. I don't know what the word for that is, but it happened twice. And so here we are, game 7. Nuggets, Clippers, huge stakes. We can talk all about it. Mr. Arnovitz, welcome back to the show. How surprised are you that we're doing this podcast?
I'm pretty damn surprised.
I got to give it to the Nuggets. So here's a remarkable stat. The Nuggets are on the verge of coming back from... Well, they're not on the verge of anything. They have a chance to come back from 3-1 again. The Nuggets for the whole playoffs are now minus 36. They were minus 48 after 4 games against Utah. So they're plus 12 since. I don't think I have ever seen a team look so bad through 4 games in the playoffs or any amount of games in the playoffs and then come back and do what they have done, taking a team that I have picked to win the title, that lots of people have picked to win the title, the distance in the manner that they are doing it. And so I emailed Kevin Pelton and I said, is there any precedent for this? And he said, well, the very first thing I did, it's hard to compare like teams bad for the first 3-4 games of the playoffs. Like, it's a hard comparison to make. He said, I just looked up every team that's been outscored by at least 40 points in the first 4 games of the playoffs. None of them have ever advanced to the second round except the Nuggets. All other teams are 0-31 or some such thing in playoff series. It's absolutely insane. I don't even know where to start. So let's zoom out here. It's funny how our minds work. If these games unfold the opposite way, like Nuggets take a big lead, Clippers come back and almost win both of them but lose, I think we feel a little differently going into game 7 than we do now. It feels like we don't have this sense of like, oh, the Clippers, they flipped off the switch. Are they choking? Are they vulnerable? Blah, blah, blah. But the way these games have happened has sort of just punched you in the gut and made you look back at all of their recent playoff history where weird things have happened to their team. So I will zoom out. Do you buy into the idea that the Clippers have all the pressure on them in game 7? They have more at stake in game 7 than the Nuggets.
Yeah, just in terms of if pressure is, if the definition of pressure is you must meet expectations. Yeah, the Clippers have more
Is that our fault? Is that pressure that we created with expectations that were too low on Denver, or is there something greater happening here?
No, I mean, I think, look, if you gave every bit of personnel on the Clippers and Denver truth serum before this series and said, okay, assess your level of confidence that you'll advance. Again, this is truth serum. Obviously, there's irrational exuberance in sports. Guys who aren't the best players in the game think they're the best players in the game. That's what gives them their edge. That's why they are where they are. Obviously, not obvious, I think the Clippers would rank much higher on that truth serum index. So in that respect, yeah, I do think it's that. I mean, the interesting thing, and you mentioned it, is when you blow double-digit second half leads, now all of a sudden there are these moral defects, right? There are these psychological defects that are ascribed to you. As you said, had it just been, you know, Nuggets play their two-man game, it's a nip-and-tuck game, they win in the final minutes the way most close games are won, I mean, I think we'd have a different conversation. But when you start talking about coughing up double-digit leads in closeout games, now all of a sudden there are all these other... By the way, whether they're true or not, and I think you and I had a similar experience watching the second half again of Game 6, but you start ascribing... it's the Clippers. Now the metaphysical gets into it. It's a curse. By the way, a 3-1 lead against Houston. Never mind that not one soul who was on the floor. Actually, the only people on the floor for the Clippers from that 3-1 series actually played for the Houston Rockets. But you start that metaphysical sportsy thing starts emanating. And well, that's what I think is weird.
There's one key person who was at his feet on the sideline for that game, for game five in Oklahoma City the year before in 2014, an absolutely epic meltdown starring Chris Paul. And that's Doc Rivers. And look, I think Doc Rivers is a good coach. I don't think there's any debate about that. However, I will say that I do buy in to the notion that there is more pressure on the Clippers. And not just because the expectations, fair or not, were higher for them this season than they were for Denver. I think two things. Number one, the Clippers, Oklahoma City owns the Los Angeles Clippers for the next 5 years. Okay, they have traded everything to create this team and get these two superstars who are on, by the way, two-year contracts, essentially. This is year one of two. And I don't care how, oh, they both wanted to come home. They picked this team. Obviously, they're going to stay. The last 5 years in the NBA has taught you, don't assume anything about anybody. Don't assume any star player is staying put, no matter how cozy it seems. So there is pressure in that sense. And number two, I do think, you call it metaphysical or whatever, 2014 meltdown, 2015 meltdown. That's the CP Blake era. Injuries kind of chip away at the rest of their playoff runs. They never really had a real chance, I don't think, after that. And this, you start adding up the history, and it just, it feels, I know that the players are all different, but I'm even thinking of like the fans, like Clipper fans. Like this becomes weighty for them. Denver's team is young. Jokic and Murray are just entering their prime. Jeremy Grant is just entering his prime. He looks like a cornerstone for them going forward. Gary Harris has come back and changed their team completely. He's young. They haven't traded 1,000 draft picks. Like, I completely believe that the Nuggets are playing with house money, and not just because of media expectations.
Oh, I think internal expectations. I mean, that was what I say. I mean, I'm with you. The Clippers have expectations that are self-imposed in addition to whatever experts are picking. What's interesting is the Doc thing. I'm always a little nervous at assigning blame. I think there's this tendency when the inexplicable happens. You know, if a guy chokes, a guy chokes. You don't lay it on the coach. I mean, so if we're going to say, hey, Doc bears some responsibility, my first question is, okay, has he not prepared this team to the extent they need to be prepared for a series like this? Is he not saying the right things? Is there not a buy-in? I don't think there's any indication that that exists. Okay, tactically, we're talking about big games, rotations. I mean, I think the one thing this morning Doc can maybe bear some responsibility for is use of the bigs, right? This has been a question, by the way, all season. There's sort of a Zubac camp and a Harrell camp. Much of it is a matter of taste. You know, for instance, I prefer Zubac. I think it gives the team defensive structure. I think it gives the team offensive structure. I say this as someone entirely comfortable with micro ball. I have no problems playing, you know, a four at the five. Hell, there are times I don't mind playing a three at the five. I just prefer this particular five, Zubac, over this particular four, Harrell, with this particular team against this particular opponent. Now, if we're going to assign blame to Doc for, you know, their underperformance, I think let's be specific in those diagnoses, right? Like, I'm not someone, and you know this, like, I'm just not someone who's going to sort of, okay, you know, sports happens sometimes. And that was J.J. Redick's kind of famous comment to me after, you know, sort of what happened against the Houston Rockets in 2015. Sports happens. Can I ask you a question? With an up 19, if you had asked anybody, is Doc Rivers being outcoached? Is Paul George shrinking from the moment? Is Montrezl Harrell killing the Los Angeles Clippers? If we had paused the recording with 17 or 19 or 20 minutes left in this series, are any of those questions answered in the affirmative?
No, and I think the Clippers are playing hard. I think Kawhi has been like in full-on sharktopus mode on defense this entire series. He's everywhere. He's playing super hard. I don't think there's an effort problem for the Clippers at all, even in the categories that we typically chalk up to effort. Defense, hustle, transition. Like, I don't see in the last two or three games anyway any problems there. Let's go to the big man issue that you brought up. Okay, Harrell is minus 29 for the series. He's minus 30, I think, if you isolate his minutes just guarding Jokic, which, by the way, people forget, Harrell's like 6'7". Harrell is not a traditional center. He plays big and tough, but you put him next to a guy like Jokic, and he's not so big anymore. So Zubats in the last three games has played 30 minutes a game. I don't know that Zubats can give you any more than that. So I don't know that the people that are you crying for Ivica Zubats to play 40 minutes and the sixth man of the year to play none or eight or six? I'm not sure that Zoo can play that much. I mean, few centers play 40 minutes really in any game, let alone, I mean, he probably would foul out guarding Jokic for that many minutes. So you can go to Jamichael Green at center, which they did toward the end of game six. You can go to Marcus Morris at center, which they have done sparingly here and there throughout the season, very sparingly. But this is the power of Jokic. Jokic is going to absolutely mash those matchups. And you saw them put Kawhi on him down the end of game six when Jokic was killing them on pick and pops. So guess what they're going to do? They're going to get Kawhi switched off him, because I don't even want to put... I'm scared of posting up Kawhi. I don't care if I'm 9 feet tall and 400 pounds. I do not want to have the ball anywhere near Kawhi Leonard. So they get him switched on to Paul George. They post him. He has an X weight advantage, whatever it is. And you double him and he's spraying passes all over the place. Like, there is just no win with Nikola Jokic on defense. There is no win other than Zubats can kind of do his best, and then you transition into Murray Jokic pick and pop, and suddenly Jokic is raining threes. He's just hard to guard. So I'm curious to hear what is the big solution that the people whining about Harrell's minutes and the bubble has not been Harrell because of a family tragedy, missed a lot of time. Lou because of a food and entertainment based thing, missed a lot of time. And so they just haven't gotten any rhythm. But I don't know what you're supposed to do, because I don't really know what the... I guess you could bench Harrell and just play Jamichael Green all the backup center minutes. I guess that's something you could do.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird series because... By the way, do you know who has the best defensive rating on the Clippers other than Pat Beverly this series?
I'm guessing Lou.
Lou Williams, right?
Because they're plus 45 with Lou on the floor, which is the best figure on the team.
Exactly. And by the way, hasn't had a great offensive series. It's just such a weird series. And to your point, it was funny because when the Kawhi matchup against Jokic happened down the stretch, my first instinct was, oh, of course. Like it's just hilarious that makes the most sense. But as you said, it forces doubles potentially. And Jokic is a guy who absolutely punishes doubles. Look, Denver's really good, right? And Mike Malone said it. You know, we were the second seed for most of the season. We were one possession away last season from conference finals. We can nitpick about their ability to close out series. The fact that, as you said earlier, four games into the playoffs, there was legitimate conversation happening of whether the Denver Nuggets had quit, which is remarkable. But I think, look, the Clippers had, I thought, a really good defensive game. Gary Harris got as many true shots as Jamal Murray. I mean, that generally speaks well for a defense. I don't think they played Jokic poorly. He made five ridiculous shots, I counted. Like
Sombor shots. Shuffle, Sombor Shuffle in the house. I love the Sombor Shuffle. Jeff Van Gundy did not enjoy it, thought it was a bad shot. It is objectively an ugly-looking freaking shot, but it is beautiful to my eyes.
Right, no, that's it. Like, he's one of those players where you suspend objectivity, and which is kind of the whole point of watching basketball at a certain extent, is you want to watch players where you have to suspend objectivity, no difference than you want to watch movies where you have to suspend your sense of reality. You and I watched the final, sort of the second half Clippers thing. I think you saw what I did. Like, I watched every single one of those empty possessions. And honestly, you know, there were a couple of critiques. You know, I think when Paul George draws Jamal Murray, like, I don't think you need to hunt for a foul, right? You just attack the guy. But they, you know, maybe they got too unselfish in transition once. Kawhi missed two, you know, shots he never misses at the rim. You know,
Kawhi missed all his pet shots in the second half. Mid-rangers where he's rising up, two chippies at the basket, like you said, one that spun and spun and spun and fell off.
Right, like there was some tunnel vision by Lou, you know, when he had Kawhi streaking down the
lane. That's just Lou vision.
Right, exactly. And by the way, that is Lou vision that often results in positive outcomes for the Clippers. I mean, Jamichael missed a corner three. He's been really reliable out there. you know, like there was some Lou Trez action, and you know, Harrell misses a runner he always makes. I mean, there wasn't when I rewatched the second half, it wasn't. And I'm not making excuses for the Clippers. It was just like, okay, you know, where's the bonehead play here? I mean, here's my only thing is I want to hear your thoughts on this. At the end of the day, I want to attack the Denver Nuggets in pick and roll. That's just what I want to do. And I think to some extent the Clippers should submit to a more conventional game plan in that respect. I mean, I think of the remaining teams in the playoffs, and this has been the case for, you know, probably a while now, the Denver Nuggets are the weakest pick and roll defensive team out there. They've got two good wing defenders right now in Grant and Harris. I just want to put them into pick and roll. And I'm not somebody who loves, you know, kind of attacking mismatches or hunting the switch, but I just think that this is a path to least resistance that I did not see enough from. It wasn't a weapon they deployed against a team that has a very specific vulnerability, you know, with the exception of Lou and Trez. And that's something that I think if you were prescribing remedies for Game 7, that's something I wouldn't mind seeing.
Well, two things. Number one, I want to give the Nuggets a little bit of credit because I do agree with you. They have holes you can pick at and things you can pick at. But since that game 4 against Utah, and again, they were minus 48 after those four games. Since that game 4, they've defended at about a top 10 level with regular season stats. They're like giving up 108, 109 points per 100 possessions. That's very, very good. And I think, and by the way, they're missing a starter. Like, let's just not forget that. Will Barton is out and has been out the whole playoffs, so they're missing a starter. Now, Grant has filled in ably and has been massively valuable to them, but still, getting Harris back, Mike Malone, now, they went all the way to the, it took them four games, and he's had all personnel coming in and out. I get it. But they got all the way to the edge, and Gary Harris coming back allowed Mike Malone to really balance his team in a way that makes sense. So Michael Porter Jr., instead of getting played off the court by Utah starters or the Clippers starters, comes off the bench, gets to face lineups that aren't as dangerous, gets to score a little bit, get himself into a rhythm before you decide, is he going to play crunch time against the Clippers' best lineups or is he not? And it just, having, I mean, Paul Millsap, for as bad as he's looked for most of these playoffs, except Game 5 where he helped save the Nuggets season, is a competent off-ball defender. He's a force. He's physical. He's big. Gary Harris is a competent off-ball defender. Jeremy Grant is a monster. You put those three guys around Murray and Jokic, and you got a fighting chance. You got a fighting chance, and they have fought. They have rotated. They have flown around. But to your general point, and it sounds weird to say it about the number two offense in the NBA, there is a certain aimlessness and purposelessness to the Clippers when they just sort of go into a haze of like, it's almost like they don't realize the advantages that they have. So I will give you one example to your point. With about 3 minutes left yesterday, game's already slipping away. They're down 8. Like I said, the Nuggets are not just coming back and hanging on for dear life. They're coming back and throwing the Clippers out of the freaking gym. But still, it's in play still. Kawhi runs a pick and roll with Zubats. Jokic switches on to Kawhi. That's it. That's the end of the possession. The entire rest of the possession should be attack, attack, attack. Kawhi passes the ball off instead. And they do some stupid stuff on the weak side. And Kawhi crosses paths with whoever Torrey Craig is guarding. And the Nuggets just switch right back. The ball goes back to Kawhi. He takes a contested 20-footer over Torrey Craig with 20 on the with 2 on the shot clock or something. Like, I don't understand how you get that matchup and just ignore it. It's like they're not paying attention. And also, I'm not just going at Michael Porter in the pick and roll every time. I'm going at Millsap every time. They have the numbers are so-so, but that, like, Kawhi, whoever Millsap is guarding, Paul George, whoever Millsap is guarding, he can't get out there and corral those guys. They're splitting him, getting into the teeth of the defense, kicking out. I want to see more of the predatory stuff that the Nuggets are doing to them when Lou Williams is on the floor. I want to see them do more of that with more of a constant focus.
Right. Look, the Clippers will never be a system team just by virtue of their personnel. But, you know, and that's what he's saying. There needs to be a little more offensive structure. You know, they have this enormous menu. I mean, as you said, hey, there are three guys they can attack. They have, you know, when Lou's on the floor, they have just three absolute devastating shot creators. And yet, they never seem yesterday to get what they wanted. At any moment, if you freeze a possession and say, okay, what are the three best outcomes? whether that be a mismatch, whether that be an action, whether that be, oh, look, the defensive balance for Denver is sort of tilted. There's weak side opportunity. It just, it was like, again, nothing they did specifically on each possession was awful, but nothing they did maximize the opportunity. By the way, Torrey Craig's given them a lot too defensively.
Yeah, Torrey, a guy I love defensively.
And you're right. I mean, all of a sudden, this team that is, oh, okay, questionably defensively has this personnel on the floor. And I also, there's this kind of, I don't know, a law of diminishing compounds where when you have one crappy defender, he's surrounded by two good defenders. He's only a little bit vulnerable, but it compounds with each successive good defender. Like when he's surrounded by three good defenders, you can almost entirely just completely obliterate the deficiency he has because there's just enough coverage overall. And so like with each passing big, a good defender, Porter's liabilities or whoever's liabilities become less and less. I mean, look, one of the dangerous things for the Clippers right now is I feel like there was a time not so long ago when a game seven, you'd sort of say, okay, the favorite has a decisive edge here. The way the game is played now, and this is not breaking news or even an original thought, you now leave yourself open to the vicissitudes of madness, right? Like all the Clippers, if Jamal Murray goes insane, which is entirely possible because we've seen it repeated times this postseason, like the Clippers could go home, right? There's no Kawhi and George can manufacture enough buckets and just wear this team down. Like the when you see Jokic hit the shots he hit, now you're vulnerable to all kinds of madness. And I just don't remember that being as much of the case when we watched basketball 10 or 12 years ago. I just feel like you came into situations like this and the favorite was the favorite. And there would have to be a sequence of events that were so improbable for the underdog to win that it was just really remote.
Well, also there's no home court advantage,
right,
which would, this game would be in Staples Center. It is not in Staples Center. It's in Walt Disney World. So there's no home court. The Nuggets have also not had home court or altitude and the advantages that they usually have. Yeah. I mean, look, like Murray going insane. You said it before. I think their defense on Murray has been outstanding the whole series, whether it's Paul George or Kawhi or Beverly. And Beverly's just got to stop fouling everything in sight. This is just a constant problem with him. He can't stay on the floor enough because he fouls everything. He fouls, and that is more than anything else, I think, why they lost, not more than anything else, but as much as anything else, why the Clippers blew Game 6 is they got in the bonus so early, or the Nuggets got in the bonus so early in the third quarter, and they just kept fouling them. And the Nuggets got to get free points and just grind and grind and grind and set their defense so they didn't have to worry about transition defense. I also thought their transition defense yesterday was outstanding. There were multiple possessions when it looked like the Clippers were going to have a 2-on-1 or a 3-on-2, and the Nuggets just like hell on wheels got back and covered it up. But they could absolutely lose, and I think it would be, I think there's no question it would be a disastrous outcome, and the Lakers have to be watching this after blowing the doors off the Rockets. By the way, what a absolutely despicable performance from the Rockets. And I don't want to hear anything about, I still think that should have been a good series. I was totally wrong. But, and I remember I texted Simmons, actually. We have a running text that about the Rockets' playoff woes and everything, that after game two, that they were going to regret that loss in game two. Because that game was there for them. And the longer that series went, I trusted the Lakers to win it more and more. And it turns out it didn't go long because game two, they lose. The Daniel House situation happens. And Houston, because they're apparently the most fragile good team in recent NBA history, completely collapses and lays egg after egg after egg. Just eggs everywhere. Eggs all over the court. And now they're gone. And by the way, I think the Rockets did the Lakers a favor and the Clippers and the Nuggets a disservice by forcing the Lakers to not play their centers. Now, I think the Lakers will play their centers no matter who. Obviously, against Jokic, you want some beef. But if it ends up being the Nuggets. So I think their centers will get chances again. But I think the Lakers realized, I think it's not as if they didn't know this all along, that Anthony Davis is a center and Bron is a four. And like we've all been saying this for 5 years. But I think they got to look at it against a team that they conceived of as a team threatening enough to make that change. And I don't think it's so much that the game got easier for LeBron and Davis. It did, right? Like, it makes a huge difference to LeBron when he's driving to the rim and there's nobody in the dunker spot. There's no defender in the dunker spot sitting there. The help has to come from the three-point line. And LeBron, that's just candy for LeBron. Like, he sees that coming 10 steps away. It's just everything gets easier for the role players. Every decision is easier for the role players. Every drive is easier. Every pass is more obvious. And I think the hook, depending a little bit on the matchup, on JaVale and Dwight can be quicker now that the Lakers have seen that in action in the playoffs and it worked so well. And I think that's bad for whoever wins this series between the Clippers and the Nuggets.
And that was always the frustrating thing about Davis's reluctance to do it, is I just feel like the game's easier for him. I mean, everything you said about space in decision-making for LeBron and the role players is I think, doubly true for Davis, who is a guy who has, you know, perimeter attributes for a big guy. I mean, he functions as one of the best rim protectors in the league. But, I mean, ultimately, you know, if I'm Davis, I want there to be less bully ball, not more bully ball on the floor. And again, they're scary. I mean, that was always to me a variable. Can they go? And it was a little tough going in because now they lost Bradley, so they lost one of those competent extra guards that you could have on the floor. And, you know, it was going to be an issue of depth and who else do they really have and which third guy and yada, yada. But it was sort of the, when are they going to look down at the ruby slippers, right? And realize they can always get home. And I think, you know, whether it was Houston, whether it's Davis just sort of coming to Jesus, whatever it is.
I think it was Houston. So the Rockets can hang a banner.
Necessity
for
is the mother of invention, right?
The Rockets can hang a banner that said, force the Lakers to adjust, 2020 playoffs, bubble, hang the banner. So to this Clippers point, the Nuggets, we know exactly how they're going to play offense, right? Yeah. Night to night, there might be some variables. Maybe you get more Jokic handling the ball and pick and rolls with Murray tonight. More post-ups. If Harrell plays more, you're just going to mash Harrell in the post. More pick and pop if it's Zubac. We know what they're going to do. The Clippers, I think, are the team that has, you know, as we talked about, some low-hanging, not low-hanging fruit, but some fruit to pick when they have the ball. And, you know, like, Kawhi has just not looked comfortable in this series when they have Jamal Murray's guy screen for him. That should be the, because they don't want to switch that, obviously. Denver doesn't. That he just hasn't looked super comfortable making plays out of that specific alignment. He seems much more comfortable with Zubats in a traditional pick and roll. And they just haven't been able to get, other than like a Landry Shamet three, where he screened and like flared out to the three-point arc, they haven't been able to get much out of that. And I wonder if, like, can they get anything out of that tomorrow? And just like, when they just amp it up a little bit, when they add just a little bit of spice, like not even hot sauce, just like a little bit of Cholula. When they add like a little bit of Cholula, they get good shots. So like, just an example, out of a timeout yesterday, they run a little screener action for Kawhi. So it's Kawhi Zubats pick and roll, but someone screens Zubats' guy on the way up. All of a sudden, Kawhi's got a little more space. Well, what do you know? On the weak side is Paul George and only Paul George. So Paul George's defender is in the torture chamber. He's got to deal with a pick and roll where Kawhi has an advantage, and he's the help guy, but he's guarding Paul George. Paul George hits a three. Like, just give me a little bit more of that. And I think the Clippers should win this game. But if it's close down the stretch, the Nuggets look so confident and so at ease, and the Clippers do not. And if the Nuggets pull this off, all kudos to them. As I said before, they've been defending at like a top 10-ish level since game 4 of Utah. Jokic is either neck and neck with Kawhi for best player in the series or just the best player in the series. The Utah series was Jamal Murray's series. This has been Nikola Jokic's series. He's an absolute monster. You cannot do anything with him other than pray. But if the Clippers, if the Nuggets pull this off, don't sugarcoat it. It's a disaster for the Clippers. And not just because they were up 3-1 and not just because they were up 19 and 18 in the last two games. It's because they were built to win this season. And this outcome is a disaster for them. It puts enormous pressure on next season. But if you're going to put a gun to my head, if you're going to put a Nerf gun to my head, I'm still picking the Clippers to win Game 7. I got to see them lose to the Denver Nuggets in a playoff series before I really believe it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't typically do predictions. I think the Clippers are, on balance, the better team, though Denver has gotten more of what they want. And you said it. Like there are things on a possession that, with intention, can yield better stuff than they're getting. And there is a bit of random basketball to this that isn't becoming of a team, you know, with this much skill. And there's a certain arrogance to it, right?
Well, like, but how much of that falls on Doc then? To go full circle to all the questions and the one constant of this team, like, does that not fall on Doc a little bit? But then again, they remind me a little bit of the Heat in year one with LeBron, where out of timeout, they come with this gorgeous stuff. And the gap between out of timeout and everything else, schematically, is just gigantic.
Right. You can't win because either there are times, you know, if it works out, Doc's a genius for trusting his guys, right? This is what the narrative becomes. He trusted his guys. Kawhi Leonard has demonstrated, you know, in two previous finals that he is the most reliable playmaker. You don't need to weight the backpacks down with playbooks. Doc trusted his guys. When they blow a 19-point lead, you know, people like you and me are saying, hey, there's no intention to their offense. That's on the coach. The coach needs to, you know, craft a system that inoculates the team from this kind of sluggishness or randomness. There are triggers that you initiate, and you get open looks for Paul George on the weak side because you're running the actions that make sense. I mean, it's tough to say. So the answer is greater than zero. The answer is also less than 100. That's his fault.
Let's just reflect for a second as we head into Game 7. And ain't nothing like a Game 7. Game 7 in the low household is I close up the laptop, don't take any notes, just lay a wash over me. There's no Game 8, no more adjustments to look forward to, no more thinking to do, just enjoy it. Can we just reflect for a second that Mike Conley 3 went in and out, and if that shot goes in, Torrey Craig goes down in infamy. The Nuggets are out. The Clippers probably beat what was a pretty wheezing Utah team by that point. That series is probably... Could we just reflect? That was one of the five craziest things I've ever seen in an NBA game. That whole sequence.
The counterfactual is fascinating, isn't it?
I mean, that thing was halfway down. Halfway down. I can't imagine. I wish there had been a camera on both front offices at that moment. Because if I were the GM of the Nuggets, I think I would have just fainted or fallen over. It's like probably even before Mike Conley took the shot. When he was rising up, I probably would have just been running out of the gym. I don't even want to see what happens. Tell me later.
Shopping for Mother's Day is usually a challenge because you wait until the last minute. Shame on you, by the way. But Macy's Gift Finder makes it incredibly fast and easy to find the right gift just in time for Mother's Day. Whether you're shopping for your sister's first Mother's Day or your fashionista mom who loves to make a statement, Macy's Gift Finder has so many great gift ideas, you can easily pick out something special to celebrate them both. You can shop by price anywhere from $25 and under to $100 and under. You can also sort by category like fragrance, handbags, more, or gift lists like for the mom who has everything, pre-wrapped gifts, gifts for grandma. You can find top brands like Studio Pro Model Beats headphones, Polaroid cameras, and Samsung smart TV. So what are you waiting for? Mother's Day is May 12th. That's very soon. It'll be here before you know it. Macy's has the perfect gift guide to make picking something for your mom easy this year. Head to Macy's.com/giftfinder today. That's Macy's.com/giftfinder.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Let's switch gears. The Eastern Conference Finals start tomorrow. The Boston Celtics will face the Miami Heat in a series that has a chance, I think, to be really, really good. In the regular season, the Celtics were a little bit better, fourth on offense and defense. Miami was seventh on offense, 12th on defense. In the playoffs, they have been two of the three most dominant teams in the NBA. Net ratings within a point of each other, absolutely dominant. I think this has a chance to be a very interesting matchup. Let's do it this way. When the Heat have the ball, when the Heat are on offense, what is interesting to you? What are you going to be watching? What are the pivot points when they have the ball?
So one of the things I realized how much I love the Heat this postseason and why it works is they have these three pillars of playoff offense. And by the way, I think this is universal. I think every team should have these. You have your pick and roll game. Number two, you have your ISO guy who can just hunt baskets when you need them, when everything kind of bogs down. And then you have what I call the third way. And the Heat have that because it's Bam, right? Like, they almost have this corner package that they've designed around Bam when he's at the right elbow. So you have these three offensive tent poles that you can go to. It's like Mike Mussina in his prime. Like, any pitch, any count. Doesn't matter the situation. Doesn't matter the defensive matchups on the floor. We have three really bedrock styles of offense that we can employ. What's interesting to me is Jimmy has been fantastic. He's taken over games. He's done his heavy manufacturing role. But Dragic has been the engine of this offense. Pick and roll, probing. He forces rotations with a penetration. He's at the very top of the floor. And often if something doesn't materialize, they'll just flip the screen and then do it again. And it works. Like, Dragic has actually been the guy who has given the most structure to the offense. And Jimmy's been amazing. He just comes in and he dominates. But that's what's been so interesting to me is, and I don't want to call it a resurgence because he was great all season. But this is different though.
Dragic as a starter has been all-star level.
Unbelievable. And that to me is the most interesting thing because now they have the most diverse offense. Again, those three things. They are amazing when it's working with Bam at the high elbow. They are amazing when it's just Jimmy being Jimmy. And they are amazing with this pick and roll game and probing that opens up all kinds of kickout opportunities. Like, you look at that personnel and you're like, is this a top five offensive team? Nah, you know, this is fantastic. And by the way, it's also a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, the Heat, Jeff Van Gundy keeps saying this every time he does a Heat game. They're just such a nice antidote to the homogeneity, which I think has actually been overstated. Like, I don't think the NBA is as homogeneous as people think it is. But when you get a nice elbow big, this is why everybody loves Jokic. When you get a nice big who can direct the offense and, like, they can run shooters all over the place, it's just fun to watch. It's just objectively fun to watch. So to your point, I think Boston is the best perimeter defensive team in the NBA. And so if you're looking for a place where this is going to be a little harder for Miami than the previous series has been, you put Smart, Tatum, and Brown on the floor together, and they're going to make life difficult for Duncan Robinson and Dragic and Butler. But the most curious thing I'm most curious about opening tip game one is, where is Kemba Walker on defense? Because I wonder if the Celtics want to put size on Dragic right away. So do you put Kemba Walker on Duncan Robinson, who Marcus Smart has guarded a lot, and trust Kemba Walker? Because little guys, like, this is the Fred VanVleet thing. Little guys are really good chasing shooters around screens. They're just littler and faster. Now, they can't contest as high because they're little, but they're good at the chasing. Do you put size on Dragic right away? Not only does that put size on Dragic, but you can start switching the Jimmy Goran two-man game. You have just a little more optionality on defense, because I do think, as much as you don't like mismatch hunting, I think the Heat are going to search out Kemba a lot in this series. And I wonder if Boston opens up right away and tries to hide him somewhere. Now, there's really no safe place to hide against Miami because of the diversity of their attack. But I'm very curious where he's going to line up to start. Yeah.
I don't want to say it's an easy call because I don't think anything's easy when there's this much talent, but I don't think it's a hard call. I mean, Marcus Smart guards Goran Dragic. We just said it. Penetration from Dragic has been the engine of this offense. You have the best ball pressure in the league in Marcus Smart. It's an easy solution. It is a problem that is solved to the extent it can be solved with the best problem solver. And then you have Robinson, who, again, is big. Robinson's a nice player. He's also not going to beat you off the dribble very often. And I think in terms of what Walker's liabilities are, I don't want to say it's an easy call, and Brad Stevens is smarter than me by a factor of a million, but it seems at least obvious. I mean, one of the things I love about Boston right now is I don't think there's a better team at impacting the ball and then retreating. Like their ability to kind of exert the kind of pressure you see from kind of hard pressure offenses and then somehow amazingly staying out of rotation. And maybe that's the size and speed and the length, and these guys can stunt and they're kind of, they have these, you know, Inspector Gadget arms, so you can kind of be multiple places at once. And I think that's part of it, but it's more than that. It's choreography. It is a fluency that they have cultivated over time. And it's like, there are times where I will just, and look, we have to see it again, because, you know, maybe it was like, okay, you know, we talked about Toronto doesn't really have a guy you have to double. They didn't really pressure the defense in the half court. And maybe it was just that. And, you know, in Philly obviously has their limitations, but I'm curious to see it against Miami. But I just, it's the number of times I will watch a defensive possession with the Celtics and say, like, how do they do that? How are they able to pressure the ball and leave themselves completely invulnerable behind it to somehow cover it up, somehow be multiple places once? Are there nine guys out there? Let me count the green jerseys. Oh, no, they're only five, because it seems like they're nine. And I, you know, so that's the thing. I have Smart on Dragic, and I don't think twice about it.
So then that leaves the question of who's guarding Butler. And remind you that a major X factor in this series is, when does Gordon Hayward come back and what condition is he in? Because Gordon Hayward guarded Butler a lot in one of the matchups, and their matchups for the regular season are borderline useless. Big players missed every game. The film is interesting, but it's not that useful. And Hayward also obviously is a massive boost to Boston's depth, because, you know, the Toronto series showed Brad is really only trusting the starters. I mean, like, Wanamaker will come in and give them minutes, pretty good minutes, and Time Lord will come in, and Time Lord gave them good minutes. But down the stretch of games, he's riding those five guys. Grant Williams comes in. You always just get the feeling that, like, they're trying to steal minutes. They're like, how long can we roll with Semi Ojeleye? Is he going to make his one random three tonight, or is he going to miss all his random threes tonight? And Hayward would be a big boost, but he has guarded Jimmy a lot. I would suspect Jaylen Brown gets it first, maybe Tatum, but they like Jaylen Brown on bigger, stronger guys more than Tatum. They like Tatum on the range, on quicker guards and using his wingspan. Brown has been the one to really take the pounding for them. I also, to me, this series pivots on Bam Adebayo. He's the most important player in the series on both ends of the floor. So, for instance, there is no law that Daniel Theis has to guard Bam Adebayo. It's not written in scripture that the center has to guard the center. The Heat will also move Bam around all the time on defense. So in theory, this may be too crazy, but I bet we see stuff like this here and there. In theory, you could put Smart, Brown, and Tatum in whatever arrangement you want on Goran, Butler, and Bam, and switch all the possible actions between those two players. Hide Theis on Jay Crowder, Theis on Andre Iguodala, hide Kemba Walker on Duncan Robinson. Now the Heat can pivot into Bam, Duncan Robinson elbow stuff to try and get Kemba switched here and there. But if you watch that one Boston-Miami bubble game, and let me zoom back, Jaylen Brown has actually guarded Bam quite a bit head-to-head because the Heat were starting Myers Leonard for the whole regular season, and Theis would guard Myers Leonard. So he has experience in that matchup. But that bubble game, whenever they messed around with a small on Bam, Bam shot 18 free throws in that game. Whenever, not even small, Jaylen Brown's not small. Whenever they put someone who was not Daniel Theis on Bam, Bam was either dunking or at the foul line. And I bet that game scared Boston a little bit. And so I think they'll start with Theis on Bam, and we'll see, and that, to your point, the natural place to then attack. I mean, Theis has been great defensively, but that gives you a shot to run sort of a lot of traditional pick and roll offense.
Right. And the reason I probably keep Theis on Bam is not so much that, yes, you do want physicality, and Brown's been great on those sorts of guys, but it's the other four, right? Like, I want those, everything I just talked about in terms of exerting pressure and then somehow retreating. It gets compromised a little bit if Theis is one of those guys on the perimeter. And that's not to say you can't bogut Jay Crowder, because I don't worry about Theis being on Crowder at all. I worry
a little bit the way Crowder's been launching like he's freaking Klay Thompson out there the last couple of months.
Right, but if you want to ISO Jay Crowder on Theis, I'm okay with it. I mean, again, that's sort of, I'm feeling okay if I'm Boston. To me, though, the problem is not bogutting Crowder. It's I want I want my the big three defensively for Boston. When we talk about the Smart, Brown, Tatum triumvirate, I want them kind of performing those functions whereby, hey, we have the perimeter covered, and oh, by the way, we can also play gaps. We can also, you know, we can also recover. We can also provide help and get back because, you know, we're this capable, we're this long, and we're this quick, and we're this smart. No pun intended. So I think that was sort of why I might not get cute with Bam. In addition to, you know, I didn't even realize what you said, that the 18 free throws. Yeah, I mean, Bam is too smart not to exploit whatever you give him.
And I have to say, against Milwaukee, he like straight up trucked Giannis multiple times. Like, he just put Giannis under the basket.
Short drives, yeah.
I have not seen anyone go at Giannis with that kind of ferocity and actually just like move him out there like it was a little guy or something. And Marvin Williams, forget it. Bam was putting that dude in the basket. You know, to me, that strategy has a great deal of risk. And you know, it if Tice is on Bam, you know, don't forget, pillar three of your, you know, the Greek pillars of Miami's offense is Bam's elbow game. Well, the Heat exploited Brooke Lopez a lot in that game by just running Duncan Robinson off Bam. You're not going to switch. You're not going to jump out. If that screen hits, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, whoever it is, has an open three. Is Tice going to chase on that? Is he going to double? Is that going to open up Bam dunks? Like, if you have a center on Bam, it unlocks some stuff for Miami that if you put a switchy guy on Bam, you can take away, but then you get punished elsewhere.
You're absolutely right. You know, it's like, and this is the genius of Miami's three pillars, right? Now, when you start running those kind of corner-esque sets and those splits, or just Duncan Robinson picking a dribble handoff, now all of a sudden Tice is in actions you don't want him in. I mean, it's funny. I've really enjoyed, I've gotten a certain appreciation for Tice because I feel like learning how to, quote, play with these guys is really the function of every big, with a few exceptions, Bam being one of those exceptions. Like, that's the NBA in 2020. If you're a big man, your job is just to learn how to play with your other guys. You clean up the mistakes, and you know how those mistakes are going to be made. You seal off a drive because you know where the drive's coming from. You know, you account for the small in your pick-and-roll defense, whether that's Kimball Walker, whoever, and you're there to support. It's kind of like Zubac has gotten pretty good at. And so mm-hmm. I was never a Tice guy. I used to be like, what is this 6'9 guy doing on the floor? Like, what is he giving you? You know, that used to be me watching the Celtics. And now it's like, oh, I get it.
He had a possession.
I really get it. Yeah.
He had a possession in game, I want to say game six. Might have been game five against Toronto, where he got switched on to Lowry. And Lowry tried three times on the same possession to beat Tice one-on-one and couldn't do it. And I was like, God damn, that is right. Kyle Lowry. Like, that's not, I don't know, pick an average. That's not like, you know, whoever. Like, that's Kyle Lowry. That's not Marcus Smart where you play off of him. And by the way, Marcus Smart, God bless him. Dude just keeps shooting. Doesn't matter. 1 of 8 from three, keep shooting. And you know what? Enough of them go in that you're like, yeah, keep shooting. Like, the guy has so much confidence. And that chase down block at the end of game seven is an all-time defensive play. Marcus Smart is an absolute monster. And Smart and Tatum won that series for Boston. There's also an interesting, when Miami has the ball, the Olynyk minutes are going to be interesting. Because we saw that Time Lord had some issues with Serge Ibaka's pick and pop game. And Olynyk is a better shooter than Serge Ibaka, when he's aggressive anyway. And the other thing that Hayward allows them to do, if he comes back, I bet we see in this series, Boston just plays their lineup where it's their five best players on the floor at once. Kemba, Smart, the two Jays, and Hayward. And that you know, minus some Bam doing damage inside, that can be a powerful lineup against this team. Grant Williams at center will be an interesting option for them in the same vein. Unless you have another Miami offense point, you want to switch gears and do Boston offense?
It's interesting we didn't even talk about Jimmy.
Because Jimmy's maybe, just Jimmy, man.
Right, Jimmy's Jimmy, right? Do his thing. Like, I don't think that's a deficient. It's just precedent, right? Like, that's sort of the thing now.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code LOW. That's code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by.
All right, let's talk about when the Celtics have the ball. Miami's defense has been outstanding. One of the very most interesting things I found when I did a little numbers dive is Miami was one of several teams in a regular season, several good defensive teams in a regular season, along with Boston, Toronto, and the Bucks, who gave up a ton of threes. 40% of Miami's opponents' shots were threes. That was the second most in the league. Boston's a very good shooting team. Obviously, the Heat have reinvented themselves with Bam at center. There's no more Myers Leonard. They're playing smaller, more Iguodala's playing power forward. Their share of opponent threes has dropped to their third in the playoffs in fewest opponent threes, has dropped 4 full percentage points. That doesn't sound like much, but if you look at cleaning the glass, in the playoffs overall, shots at the rim are down significantly. And all of the uptick, all of the compensatory uptick has come in threes. Threes are way up. So for Miami to deflate threes in the playoffs is a big deal. And you want to say, well, they played Indiana.
I was going to say Indiana was going to be my explanation.
So that was my explanation too. Then I zoomed in on the Bucks series. They completely warped Milwaukee's shot selection in the exact same way. The Milwaukee's threes were way down. So Miami has figured out a little something on defense. What are you looking? So the same way that we talked about, I think the Heat are going to search out Kemba Walker. I think on the other end, we're going to see Boston searching out Dragic, Robinson, Hero, I think is going to be sort of point one, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's exciting about Boston right now is just watching Tatum develop his off-speed game, right? Like he's a guy who has finally realized you can use your size and strength to get what you want. And by slowing down, you get to see things that might otherwise be there if you're driving at full speed. And so to the extent that they need a drive and kick game against Miami, which I think is sort of what you need, again, depending on how Miami kind of plays that perimeter, watching Tatum become a playmaker, because this is where Hayward becomes useful, right? Like, you want the number of guys who can make a play off the dribble in a series like this.
Well, you saw it against Toronto, right. And I think this is going to be a big deal in this series. Pelton nailed this in his preview. Miami was the best and most frequent zone team in the regular season. They haven't played any zone in the playoffs. I would be shocked if they don't come out with zone in game one right away, because they saw what the zone did, which is take Kemba Walker's pick and roll game out. And without Hayward, Boston was left to really, I mean, every basket was hard.
Yeah. And that's the thing is can they avoid getting stuck in the mud? Because at the end of the day, as much as I, you know, we all love these guys, you know, who can make a play off the dribble and sort of, create second opportunities, not second shots, but sort of, you know, actions that get stunned, that gets just sniffed out. You go to the other side, and I think they're really, if Hayward can play, that can be extremely useful. Because again, if Kemba's taken out, now it's Tatum making plays. And by the way, I love what's happening there. I love that he is becoming a guy, but it's still not his inclination. It's certainly not Brown's inclination. I mean, generally speaking, if the ball goes to Brown, you know, with 8 seconds left on the shot clock, Brown is going to take a shot, and irrespective of its difficulty or its opportunity, it is sort of a set thing. So that's going to be really interesting. Is, you know, who can make a play when the thing gets bogged down for somebody else? I mean, who can sort of scramble the defense outside? And by the way, there's nothing wrong with Tatum one on one off the dribble on occasion, and there are going to be great opportunities for him to do that. Here's my question to you is okay, so what are the matchups if you're Miami on Boston? Who do you put on whom, especially now that you've got some guys who are, you know, you get concerned about in one-on-one situations?
Well, it's a little harder to hide Dragic now that Robinson is also in the starting lineup as a potential target. And I think Robinson has really advanced on defense. He competes. So, you know, it's not as easy as just,
got size. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not as easy as just put Dragic somewhere else. So, like, where else are you putting him? You know, I think Bam Bam will probably start on Tice. Bam will start on Tice. I'd be surprised if he doesn't start on Tice, but Bam can guard anyone. And, you know, if he's on Tice, that's your primary screen setter, right? So the Heat are playing man-to-man, not zone. Right. Okay, we feel comfortable with Bam on Tice because Bam is going to destroy your pick-and-roll game. If he switches on to Kemba, I don't think Kemba's going to have, like, huge success attacking Bam off the dribble. I don't think Jason Tatum's going to have huge success taking Bam off the dribble. And I don't think they care a whit, W-H-I-T, whit, about Daniel Tice doing anything to their guards on the back end of those switches. So that's and of course, then the easy thing, then the natural pivot for Boston is, well, if we can't do anything with Bam, we got to put Tice away somewhere on the side. We just can't play through Tice anymore. And then that becomes when you have the Walker-Tatum pick and roll, the Tatum-Walker pick and roll, the Walker-Brown pick and roll. Find me the weak point and bring that guy up to screen or bring his guy up to handle the ball and one of my other good guys will screen. Tatum is a screener, I think, has become an interesting thing for them. And that was the only thing Indiana had against Miami. And it was pretty successful in the first round was they just let their guards play one-on-one. Once they got a matchup they liked, they let Malcolm Brogdon play one-on-one. And although Indiana's offense was crapola in that series, that particular subset of it was not crapola. In fact, it was very good. And so I think we might just see some straight-up ISO play from the Celtics perimeter players when they get a matchup that they want. The key for that is, do you do it early enough in the shot clock? And do you do it with the intention of not taking a contested turnaround 15-footer, but getting to the rim or spraying out for threes?
Right, but to your point about Bam, now he's Mr. Help Defender. Now he's at the nail when you do that stuff. And look, I mean, they got some great stuff out of Tice over the top of the defense, alley-oop, and it was wonderful.
That's true. In fairness to Tice, they did. They really did.
Right. And there's stuff there. There are points to pick up there. But, you know, Bam on Tice also frees him up in moments where Tice isn't in the primary action as a screener to just be at the nail, just totally sniffing. I mean, you're going to have to come at the top of the floor because those sort of wing attacks from Tatum are going to be, I mean, look, he's really, really good. But I think, I don't want to say, oh, it's a low scoring series, but I think it's going to be a low scoring series. Like, I think this is going to be a defensive slog in repeatedly. And now watch, it'll be game one, 121, 114. But, you know, Bam is just so, you know, Bam's trouble no matter where you try to attack the Heat.
Well, that's because, why you just nailed one of the reasons why I considered Bam the pivot point of the series. Because even if the Celtics decide, which is what Indiana did, they were just like, you know what, Miles Turner, you're giving us nothing as a screen setter. Bam is just eating us alive. You just go in the corner, take Bam with you, get out of the way. Well, Miles Turner is a better shooter than Tice by a decent degree. If they do that, Bam then becomes Help Defender Bam, which is no less frightening than anything else Bam is going to do. So, I mean, he holds a lot of this series in his hands on both ends of the floor. And that's why I think, despite the temptation to sort of finagle around with matchups, like we could put Crowder on Tice, put Bam on Tatum, put Bam on Brown, really put Bam in the muck of their core actions. I think those are things we could see late in close games. I think late in close games, we could see Bam deployed as just wherever they want. You guard Tatum for one or two big possessions. But I think Bam on Tice is a good matchup for them in a lot of different ways. But the Heat showed in their, and maybe that's why the Heat tried Jay Crowder on Giannis from the jump in the last series, is it rather than expend Bam as the one-on-one defender he's fully capable of being against Giannis, let's have him guard Brook Lopez and sort of wreck things all over the floor.
Yeah, I want him as a rover. I mean, that's not to say there aren't great one-on-one opportunities, like you said, in specific situations. You know, you need to slow a guy down. You want to mix things up. You want to throw an off-speed pitch. I mean, I'm all for that. But to me, Bam is most dangerous when you don't know where and from where and when he is coming. And, you know, as a rim protector, once the possession breaks down or once penetration has been made.
And if he starts exploiting size advantages early in the series the way he did in that one game in the bubble, and you don't want to take too much from one game. But then again, you know, the head-to-head matchup games between Toronto and Boston are why I picked Boston in that series. I mean, obviously, they barely escaped by the skin of their teeth. But if he starts abusing size mismatches early, it's a bad sign for Boston. I think this is a frustrating series to pick, partly because of the Hayward issue, right? We don't know when he's coming back and how he'll look. You know, people have speculated mid-series. I've seen that sort of speculated online. If he were healthy, I think I would pick the Celtics for sure. I'm still leaning Celtics in seven. That was my official. I picked Celtics in seven. That should be on the website by now. But honestly, I don't know. I really don't know. I what I defaulted to was two things. I think the Heat have not seen a top to bottom perimeter defense like this, and that's going to make some of their pet actions a little bit more difficult than they have been in previous rounds. And I think Boston's perimeter players can make some hay against Miami's guards. But the zone defense gives me a lot of pause, because you know Miami watched that Toronto-Boston series and was like, ooh, that's interesting. They don't look super comfortable against the zone. Noted.
I have no idea. I mean, I seriously don't. Miami is such a departure from what I saw in the regular season. And by the way, they were a good team in the regular season. I just they have shocked me. And I didn't totally appreciate just those three pillars, just how they're able. They just don't go cold for very often. And it's because, okay, this isn't working, we go to this. There's such a method to their play, both offensively and defensively. They're so creative and confident in that creativity defensively, as you said. Yeah, we're just going to throw a zone out there. Never mind that we probably have two and a half or two below average defenders on the floor at all times. I mean, we were talking a little bit about this with Denver, except with Miami, it's so much more advanced. And then there's the BAM factor. And I call it like Big Lowry. I mean, there are nights where he gives you 11 points, you know, 10 rebounds, 4 assists, and he's the best player on the floor. There are possessions, there are stretches in the game where he's actually controlling the game, either because he's providing that, you know, the fulcrum of that offense, because, you know, as a help defender, the opponent can't really figure out, you know, where the seam is in this half court defense. They're a really good transition defensive team, as is Boston, by the way, who might be the best. I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, there's not going to be any easy buckets in this game. These are two disciplined, smart teams who don't screw up in transition. They don't screw up on the glass. A couple areas of interest just statistically. Miami was the number one free throw generating team in the NBA this season. They were number one in free throw rate. Boston was like 22nd or 23rd in fouling. Can Miami win that battle, and by how much? And Boston was like 6th or 7th, I think, in forcing turnovers. Miami was a little loose with it here and there. I think they were like 20th in turnover rate or something. Can Boston win that battle? Those are those little games within the game, particularly the free throw game. I mean, that's the primary reason why Jimmy Butler had an unbelievable offensive season, despite shooting horribly from almost everywhere. He was at the foul line like he's James Harden. So I think this is a fascinating series. I'm actually more excited for this than I was for Boston and Toronto, and I was unreasonably excited for Boston. Like, I was more excited for Boston and Toronto than I am about, like, regular life things. I don't really want to say which one, because I'll get...
You need to get out more, Zach.
I'll get in...
It's hard to get out, right?
Exactly. How can I get out anywhere? I can't do anything.
I just answered my own question, right.
I'm excited when I see a neighbor walk out of their house and I can wave at them. I'm very excited for this series. Any final thoughts on Boston-Miami before we let you go?
No, I just, it's been really fun to watch Boston blossom. It's just like, they've never been selfish, but they were young. So selflessness wasn't this defining quality, and that's just changed. I mean, yeah, Brown occasionally takes some iffy shots, but it's been really fun to watch, and Marcus Smart, obviously, but it's just been fun to kind of watch it come together. And they sort of know how they want to play now. It's not to say that every problem is solved immediately, and we saw that in the Toronto series. I mean, it can take a while. They're going to be just droughts while they figure it out, but they do figure it out, and that's just been fun to watch. And again, Miami has been the best story to me of the playoffs.
All right, Mr. Kevin Arnovitz, read everything, listen to everything he does at ESPN.com. Thank you, sir, and enjoy the series.
Thanks for having me.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, You're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.